Welcome to Faith Uncut, a podcast where we explore faith in ways that might get you kicked out of most churches. I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
And first, we want to say a big thank you to our homies, our friends and family over at the Brown Liquor Report. Hopefully you checked it out. We completed our run of A Shot and a Prayer, where we started pre-election, went through the election with our election coverage and thoughts. And then we had another event after that, and we came back and did a follow-up episode. So it's always nice to kick it with the fam, and we had a good time over there. So if you haven't checked it out, check out BLR. Throw a little bit in their collection plate on Patreon, the Brown Liquor Report. And yeah, that's the fam.
Yes, we appreciate it. That small little tidbit, that other event that occurred before we were able to wrap up the series. Can we revisit that?
Yes,
the event that we are alluding to is this little itty bitty insurrection that was had at the Capitol building on January 6th. That was a surreal experience for the world, honestly. You know, I want to say it was a surreal experience for the local area, for even the nation, but it was surreal all around the world. So today we're just going to kind of jump into what was in the atmosphere that manifested that energy that we saw, and what we can do about it now, because a lot of that, a lot of the imagery actually was tied to some religious fervor. And here at Faith Uncut, we had talked about the writing being on the wall, and I think some messages got written that day. So we're going to jump right in.
Yeah. So for anyone who caught any of those images, one thing that was, it seemed to be a contrast, was you had white nationalists, and then you also had Christian groups out there. So you would see crosses being lifted up. You had the Jewish war horn, the shofar being blown. Yeah. We saw that earlier when the former president took a medical victory lap at Walter Reed, and they were out there blowing the shofars. And so we saw these two groups who you would think don't have enough in common to execute something like that, but they were shoulder to shoulder in this act of insurrection. And it's something that we got to talk about. And it's funny that it got to this point, and now you hear a lot of questioning like, well, has this gone too far? How do we get here? Like,
I know it's not funny, but it is, because I'm cackling in very centered blackness, deeply rooted blackness that tends to sound the alarm on things. So let's just frame up where the insurrection came from. Let's give some background on this. So as everyone knows, we recently concluded the 2020 presidential election. And along with that election, there were congressional races for the Senate as well as the House of Representatives, local races, new governors, new local leaders. So people just participated in a very draining election season where the incumbent, 45, was trying to discredit the system before the voting took place. And this constant messaging, he really stayed on message about the election being somehow fraudulent if he does not win. And even though he had tried that in 2016, he actually won. So I feel like the fraud claims went away. But this time, as we know, Joe Biden won not only the popular vote, but the Electoral College vote. And almost immediately, everybody on the other side, on the right side, on the Republican side, representing about 75 million votes themselves, began to disclaim the election. And it wasn't, you know, one size fits all. There was definitely a lot of pushback. This is where Trump's campaign filing multiple lawsuits and also having those lawsuits thrown out of federal court, trying to challenge certain states' results, has come from. So it wasn't without political theater, as you would call it. You know, it's not that he just said, oh, it's a lie. He said it. I mean, not oh, it's a lie. It's not that he just claimed that the election was fraudulent, but they took steps to almost claim that somehow the deep state, this idea that somebody, some entity does not want them to be leaders or does not want them to be in control, push them out.
Right.
So this messaging keeps going, and they start talking about this date, January 6th. Now, I don't know why anybody was paying attention. Okay, we'll get into that a little later. But on January 6th, there was a rally in D.C. It's the same day as Congress was coming together to symbolically certify the results of the election. And there's some debate, but not really to me, that people were called to a mob. And when mob mentality takes over, violence usually is right there. And this was no different. So what ended up happening is what we saw. There was a storming of the Capitol. And to the point that there was a religious factor in this. There was a some sort of representative Christianity factor to this. We have to really get honest about what that means about our presence in the society and, you know, what are we collectively putting our energy behind? So the insurrection is still unresolved, but that is something that we actually saw as a result of our free and fair election system. So, you know, here we are.
Yeah. When you say our, in terms of how we are representing it, our, I want to extricate myself from that group because I don't think you and I and the people who listen to this show and people who, a lot of people who look like us, are not the people that are out there doing those things. And you would hear people comment on that, like, the, you know, there was a discrepancy in how different people were policed with regards to the events at Lafayette Square, contrasting that with what happened on January 6th. But again, that's not us. And so seeing that Christian presence out there, it's odd for a group who follows Jesus, who sat with the disciples, Peter and the other disciples, and asked, what does it profit a man to gain the world and lose his soul? For those to be the words of the person that you follow, you have to ask yourself, well, what did they gain from this? Like, they gained some conservative judges. They gained, I'm going to say, 226 conservative judges on the federal judiciary.
And three Supreme Court judges.
And three Supreme Court judges. So that's what they traded for, giving up their moral standing, their beliefs that they hold, that everyone knows that you believe this thing. And now you're acting as if those things don't matter enough to you to actually change the way that you, or change who you support. So they gave up all of that standing that they built up, as we talked in the abortion rights episode, that they started with that political capital, and all of that was sacrificed because they tied themselves to a party and did not ask the questions or did not care to interrogate how this party, even though it can get them some of the things that they want, how does it actually perform when it's measured against their beliefs?
You know, power is intoxicating, and I think that this has been a long moment coming. There's been a lot of investment in what we saw, quite frankly. You know, millions of dollars have gone into marketing and into messaging that, one, muddies the waters and misconstrues what issues actually are. You know, there are some people playing some dirty communications games with their constituents. They're not being honest. They are misleading them intentionally, you know, in the short term for long-term gain. Like, that's a byproduct of what we're seeing. But this part of what we say is conservative Christianity began to enjoy a lot more political weight in the last 40 years. And I think that, right or wrong, you know, again, we need more days. You need almost, you're going to need years to look back at this time and see what the true cost was. But it almost feels like it was like an urgency to cash it in. And the only thing that I can think of that they're cashing in is the longer term investment that they've made at maintaining the status quo so that the changing demographics of the country don't change the power structure. People who deny that whiteness is an implicit part of the power structure, 9 times out of 10, are struggling with whether or not what happened at the Capitol was really a crime or not, or if those people need to be understood more than they need to be prosecuted. But people who have never participated in the power structure and or to the level that they should and have never seen that outsized representation or that privilege are wondering if are we all going to be governed by the same laws? Are we all going to be treated the same? And I think that now we're going to see this power structure try to figure out, you know, How do I police myself? And it's going to fail. You know what I mean? It's going to fail. I don't think that people calling themselves Christians should have been able to get this far, misrepresenting some of our ideals, not knowing that this type of destruction could be around the corner.
And they were told. They were told many times.
Many times. They were told many times. But power, if not for the power, I mean, it. Maybe I'm not tripping off of, you know, some people aren't starstruck. But in this last entity, you had somebody who catered to people being starstruck, who catered to ego a lot, you know? And now what you say is carrying weight, but it's carrying weight with, you know, not the sharpest knife in the drawer. You know what I mean? So for power's sake, now you see what it has meant for us to drag to the right on certain issues and not call thing, you know, call a thing when it comes to white supremacy versus is this good policy? Some of this is not about policy.
I want to be very clear that it wasn't just that this person leveraged his stardom, because if that person would have been black or indigenous or some other person of color or a woman, there's no way that they would have followed that person over a cliff like they just did in this insurrection. So what's going to happen is we're going to see a lot of calls for forgiveness. And that's usually the card that comes out real fast from people who know they made a mistake. The Bible says forgive. And Jesus said, forgive, you know, 70 times seven. And it's almost like we can do whatever we want, as bad as it is. And at the end of the day, ask for forgiveness, because that's a value that we espouse. But you don't believe your own values. You just demonstrated that. So why would everyone else be beholden to a value that you yourself don't even believe?
I don't think they're ready for society to treat them with that level of accountability. But I also think that that moment is here for some. There's always a group that was resistant to treat people who had differing opinions, you know, so bad for their opinions. And I'm not saying that we should. I'm just saying that you shouldn't have to unify with people who unify with policies or ideals that say that your life is not valuable. You shouldn't have to. You should not be beat over the head to forgive people who were just recently trying to kill you and have not apologized.
Yeah.
You know, who just broke into your house and have not said that was wrong of me to do. So I think you're going to see a massive resistance to this blanket of forgiveness, but that blanket of forgiveness is nothing but privilege. You know, let's talk about the difference between what we saw in this area or at the White House over the summer versus what we saw on January 6th, you know? People were protesting in the wake of the George Floyd police murder, and this man lost his life and riots erupted and people were in the street, not least of which was in downtown D.C. And you had 45 come out of the White House one day because he wanted a photo op, and he forcibly cleared, like as you mentioned earlier, Lafayette Square for that op where he had holding the Bible. Mm-hmm. He was holding the Bible. And people talked about the symbolism of that. And, you know, and I think the ideas of has it gone too far started. I think people who have not wanted to call a thing started saying, is that what we represent? But the truth of the matter is politically, yes. Mm-hmm. Politically, yes. You know, this entity, this block, this voting block put some salt in the game. And it's going to take years to overcome it.
Yeah.
It's going to take years to overcome that. And we see us being treated differently. And we're wondering, are y'all going to treat people who just committed seditious acts?
Right.
You know, is everybody going to get to go home and wait it out? Is everybody going to get house arrest? Because when it's us, you respond with the military. Like, the pictures don't lie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, George Floyd, his alleged crime was paying for something with a counterfeit $20 bill. Mm-hmm. And so he lost his life behind that. And so now we have people who attempted to overthrow the government and violate what the Constitution says should happen.
Because they don't read it, but it's okay. That bothers me so much. It bothers me so much that people are calling themselves patriots, not realizing that they're really acting more like redcoats. But that's a whole nother episode. Mm-hmm. But it's a misrepresentation of the history. And for me, you know, in my circles, we realize that it's an intentional misteaching of it as well. You know, mm-hmm. people need assistance with developing their understanding of history.
Yeah.
This is a reflection of how many things have been allowed to be mistaught and misstated as people come into understanding of how their country works. It's amazing to me. It's amazing that it worked.
This wasn't part of the show, but since you brought it up, as I'm watching all of this happen and seeing this issue with what's being taught versus what's being understood, it occurs to me that the myth of American individualism is something that white people must tell themselves to distance themselves from the people who have committed atrocities like this in the past. So we talked before about the fact that black people share this collective consciousness, and it's not just black people. Other people groups do this. But for some reason, white Americans, at least, tend to think of themselves as separate from the collective. So the example we used was like the spate of mass shootings that were occurring before COVID-19. Like it didn't seem like there was a collective consciousness to say, well, a lot of these people look like us. We should be doing better. Contrast that with the DC sniper, where you had one incident where the person was black and black people felt that everywhere. Or 9/11, where Middle Eastern Muslims felt that immediately, despite the fact that they got out and tried to help and provided financial support. There's a collective responsibility that American individualism denies white people from assuming. And that means that you never have to look in the mirror. You never have to say, if I look at history, then we've done a lot of things that we need to atone for.
That's actually amazing, because then when you look at historical examples of mob violence, you know, what does that persistence of individualism mean about the mob violence? It means it never happened, because you can then convince yourself that it was somebody else's idea. It was somebody else's energy. It was somebody else's actions. And you just happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time, or regardless of the outcome of whatever the mob has done, because that was not your intent, you don't carry the same responsibility. Of course, other groups do not experience that. And I mean, now we can look at verifiable policies, such as, you know, why are people, you know, always checking with somebody, you know, before they get in a car? Is there anything in the car? Because you have laws that say that if I find a gun in the car, everybody's getting charged the same. But when you juxtapose that law with high contact policing and racism and, you know, propensity for brutality, you see that that is yet another way to wipe out a group of people, most likely who might be black. You know, you get them, you get four for one. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Four people in the car, but for one gun, you get, you know, 20 years served amongst all of them. So what the six robbed this group of was the ability to continue to say, but not me. Because we saw all of y'all. Like, not, and it wasn't everybody, but for the group that was there, it was so out in the open and it was so public. And again, because no one's hand has been smacked or no one's been turned off from using the religious imagery, it's right there in your face who these people say that they are. We didn't say who they were. They told us. It's a lot to process on this side, because I think it goes back to our constant conversations about making sure that our worship practices, something, I mean, it gets to, you know, the outward worship, but then also our affiliations. Make sure that you're affiliated with something that honors you, because I don't think a lot of people were running around feeling represented by what happened on the 6th, who also call themselves Christians in other groups. I don't think they felt that. Somehow that group felt like they were fighting for all Christians. And that's not it for the nobility, not for the accuracy, but just for the nobility of it all. And that's not accurate.
Decades ago, Chris Rock had a bit about black people setting us back. And this was like in the late 90s. Like, we knew this. Like, if you showed up to the movie theater and it was a, you know, mixed crowd, but your ringtone was going off and it was Nelly or whatever, like, you were setting us back. And so that collectiveness is felt amongst everybody. Like, this is old. We've known this.
Yes, I cringe when people are embarrassing themselves. I'm like, I didn't give you permission to do this to me.
Right. And so you talk about the alliances and who we ally ourselves with. Black Christians really do have to start to ask themselves some questions, specifically Black evangelical Christians or Black Christians who are white adjacent in terms of how they worship, who they pay attention to, who they read, who they invite to speak to their congregations. And one of the things that's been frowned upon in the Black church is this idea of questioning God. And so you just can't ask certain types of questions, which is the idea that this show is built around. Like, you should be able to ask these questions.
Yeah.
But without that, you get into some spaces where you may find it difficult to get out of. And so the question is, does the church have an obligation to teach its congregants from the pulpit on Sunday mornings how to ask these questions in a healthy way?
The short answer is yes. The longer answer is probably more so how, without, again, challenging. It all depends on where your power structure is, because I don't think that's a threatening proposition if your whole goal is to teach critical thought and helping people how to discern, you know, information, quality of information and sources. I don't think that would undermine a leadership. But then if you're under bad leadership, unless the truth is some of us are under great leadership, some of us are under not so great leadership, people are not going to teach you how to interrogate them. They're not going to teach you how to interrogate their power structure, not intentionally. So yeah, I mean, do we have a responsibility? Absolutely yes, because there are people who rely on the church like other people rely on secular schools to teach them.
Right. So you got to think that in some Black Christian circles, a lot of what you hear coming from a pulpit Sunday morning is things that help you improve your life or help you improve your standing in the world. And yes, those things are important. But if that's the majority of what you're hearing, then I question, what are you not hearing? Because everything can't be about you improving yourself, because at that point, you've just bought into that myth of American exceptionalism or individualism. Mm-hmm. And that's not our thing. And so you've adopted something that is not healthy for you. And that becomes the diet that you eat every Sunday morning. So in seminary, we often talk of this phrase, a hermeneutic of suspicion. And what that means is you read the text with a critical eye, not just accepting what's there, but asking questions of the text. It's not that you disbelieve it. One of the examples, let's say Moses was a Hebrew. He was put into a basket and picked up by the Pharaoh's daughter and raised in Egypt as an Egyptian. But his name is a Hebrew name. So who gave Moses that name? Because the Pharaoh's daughter could not have known if he had a Hebrew name. So why would the Egyptian Pharaoh name this child this Hebrew name? So then the question is, who's writing the text? Who's was that Moses' real name? Is that really what happened? Is that the legend that we tell or whatever? So a hermeneutic of suspicion causes you to ask good questions of the text, and then you start to go down the path of investigation. You end up understanding more about the text. And so without asking questions, you leave yourself vulnerable to this. In discipleship, Christian discipleship, a lot of times it's about memorization. Like, this is what 1 Corinthians 15, you know, such and such says, or this is if you have questions about health, wealth, or healing, or prayer, or whatever, these are the scriptures for you. It can't be about memorization. It needs to be about critical thinking. And so in our discipleship, are we teaching people to think critically? In our sermons on Sunday, are we teaching people to ask questions of the text? That's how a good sermon should be prepared. You should have some questions of that text, because you are who you are, and this thing may not make that much sense to you.
Right.
And so what do we do with that? What we saw in the insurrection causes us, or should cause us, to question what we understand and believe about prophecy and the role of prophecy. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the episode that we spoke about this in. I wish I could, so I could direct you to the episode. But anyway, the short version is that a lot of people believe that the prophecy of the Bible, the vast majority of it, is future telling about things like, so for instance, telling about Christ and messianic prophecies, or telling about the end times in Revelation. And that's not really how the prophecy in the Bible works. We discuss how a lot of this is written with the benefit of hindsight. So an event occurs, nothing's written down in real time in the event. These writings occur later, so they're looking back on the event, interpreting those writings, and it looks like the writing occurred before the event or during the event, but really that's not the case. And so writing with the benefit of hindsight looks like future telling if you don't understand when the thing was written and when the events happened. There's also writing as a literary genre. So we see this in Revelation, where they're writing to talk about the current oppressive regime in Nero, and they're doing it in code so that they won't be killed for passing around this letter, but they can still write it in a way that people can understand it. So they're writing a code, not necessarily a code for the end of all creation, but it's their hope for the end of their current oppression. And this is how it's articulated. So some church traditions get it more right than others. So you have AME, some Black Baptist churches get it right. Some Black, I can think of a Black Baptist church, a few of them in this area that are more aligned with white evangelical Christianity, or as we talked about before, this American civil religion that looks a lot like Protestant Christianity. And some don't do it so well. So you have to be aware in as you enter these faith spaces, you know, what am I being taught? How are they teaching me? Are they teaching me to memorize something? Are they teaching me something that I'm going to feel good about, but just good enough so that I can come back next Sunday? They ain't nothing but giving people potato chips for a meal. Like, you just gave them enough nutrients to get them through, and then they got to come right back and get that same junk.
Yeah, but that's the issue that we have with prosperity preaching, though. Like, it's only focused on this one thing, you know, about wealth building and God's going to bless you, and if you're a good person, you're going to be rich, basically. And that's really nothing but thinly veiled capitalism. That's capitalist Christianity. And it has its downside. And like you said, it doesn't benefit us if we are not being taught to think critically about what that prosperity and what that wealth building, and because a broke clock is right twice a day. So it's not all bad. But we have wondered, you know, who's gaining from constantly going to poor neighborhoods, building bigger churches, pulling more tithes, and maybe not investing in the same places where the congregation comes from? And we see who that is. You say who's aligned with whom? We see it. Mm-hmm. And we've said, you know, think critically. We said that at the beginning of the pandemic. You know, you're listening to these faith leaders, but are you listening to what they're saying? Because in your group, the statistics look different, and you have to honor that. You have to honor that, you know, if you don't have access to healthcare, or you work a certain class of job in a certain area, and your job class is not treated the same way as, let's say, the 40 hours a week office worker, you know, you have to be able to think critically about how processing and applying certain information is going to affect your situation. Mm-hmm. Your situation is not my situation.
Absolutely. We hear this phrase, existence is resistance, related to Black people. That's how you should show up in your faith spaces. You can be around your white Christian brothers and sisters, but your existence in that space does let them know things are not equal here. Like, yeah, I see what you're doing over here. This is what we're relegated to doing over here in order to survive. These are your problems, you know. Whatever those problems are, I'm not going to make light of predominantly white problems, but then we got these problems over here. You know, we can't go out outside our homes, or sometimes sleep safely inside our homes. And so we need to have a discussion. We can worship together and all these things, but we can't just talk about your stuff when we got all of these major things happening over here.
And I think the reason why I'm just like, exactly, is because, again, now we're on the other side of this event, and we're getting a lot of those videos and those stories. You know, what made you do it? What motivated you? What were you thinking? All of this. And I think there is this idea amongst people who think of themselves in this type of far right identifying group, or this, you know, fringe conservative type of thing, where they think that nobody is paying attention to their problem. Nobody thinks that they're experiencing a problem. And I don't think it's that. And that's a crazy way to hear it for me to say, but I have problems too. I think what we're speaking to is the fact that you have more access to have your problems impacted or solved. So, you know, to hear people saying that they had to storm the Capitol to take their country back, and then when you get into the nooks and crannies of how the country wasn't really being taken from them, that sounds weird because it's like, wow, you really felt like you could participate in overthrowing the government for your general discomfort with the change in demographic, or let's throw the baby out with the bathwater because no longer is it guaranteed that your state is going to vote a certain type of way because the population has changed.
Right.
You know, this is what we see in Georgia, or this is what we see in the resistance to certify these election results, is that playing on time-worn stereotype tropes, fraud, where you see high numbers of African Americans voting. I feel like the church, the Black church, has to be tapped into that, because our church is more than just the physical building on Sunday. It is an institution for learning. It is an institution for information sharing. We talked about the church as an institution. It's not just this one building for this one purpose. It's still very much so a part of our community. You know, even with the evils of gentrification, we still have Black churches that are the anchor that continue to pull people in and have them serving that immediate community.
I mean, so I guess the question becomes, what will it take for the American church to tire of being on the wrong side of history? Because we've seen many times that they choose the wrong side, whether that's in slavery, in segregation, in discrimination against women and LGBTQIA plus persons. They've chosen the wrong side in this insurrection. And these are disastrous choices for the whole of America. Their position, their we can call it whiteness, but in where they exist in society, they are insulated from the impact of a lot of these choices, whereas everyone else is getting crushed by these choices. But at some point, this group has to ask themselves, why do we keep choosing wrongly in things that matter this much? They want to be able to live and move and act and do things that they think are right, but so often the things that they think are right are
actually wrong.
Terribly wrong. And so what is it going to take for them to realize that, yo, we're wrong a lot of times, so maybe we need to listen to something else or recalibrate what it is that we're thinking and moving?
I mean, in the short term, I think that it's this commitment always to tell the truth, because that's what's getting distorted. You know, people's, not your individual truth, but like actual facts. Like the problem with dealing with leaders who distort facts and who try to distort reality is that it messes with your basic critical thinking, you know, schema. And if you get to a point where you don't know what's real and what you should react to and what you should respond to, I feel like your feelings and emotions have an outsized contribution to your decision-making palette. And that's not always positive, because how you feel might not be supported by factual evidence.
Right.
And that stops us from having a functioning society, because if everybody starts getting in their feelings, I'm going to tell you what, people are not going to be happy, because their feelings still won't be the ones that matter. You know, if we were all allowed to just, you know, operate in our, within our emotions and not within some places where we have agreed upon facts. The other thing is that we have to never shy away from the commitment to make sure that we are teaching correctly. You know, the sad part of this is that it's going to take years to educate this out of the population, to educate some of this misinformation and misunderstanding of how our institutions work, how our elections work, getting people out of the habit of skimming just internet sources. We've talked about, you know, do you know where your information comes from? And do you know how to vet the sources of your information? And it's sad, because the six also represents a number of people who were getting their information from very specific sources that told them very specific things. People from all over the country were able to say damn near the same thing about how they got caught up in the fervor of participating in this insurrection. And that is very important, because, yes, it's very easy to say, oh, it's the media. But it wasn't just the media. It was some of your faith leaders, too. It's all over some of these Christian networks. You know, I've spent a lot of time with my elders, and I have an elder who used to love watching Copeland. On TV. And I came to her home and saw what Copeland was doing. And I was like, this man is not well. And I'm but one person in one home. So imagine how that's going over for people who refuse to hear or listen to anything else, who refuse to, you know, to open up their sources. And they think that they think that their opinions are not respected. But your opinion, even if I respect it, does not become a fact. You keep telling people that they get to feel good or bad about what is. And I've always said that Black people just got in touch with their feelings about 60 years ago, because up until then, we didn't have any, right? Mm-hmm. Up until then, a part of your dehumanization is robbing you of your happiness as well as your ability to be sad, your ability to be angry. But for the people who are fully humanized, they get to be happy, sad, angry, mad, all the different isms and things. And that gets to guide and set the reality for everyone else.
Yeah.
That's not the world that a lot of people are living in.
As I'm thinking through how we get to this point or how they got to this point, one thing I noticed that is that Christians who follow Paul usually make a lot of these mistakes. And they make these mistakes more than Christians who follow Jesus. And I don't know that people are aware of the differences. And so Christians who follow Paul tend to have a certain view of women that women cannot maybe preach or lead. Deacons must be husbands and things, because things that Paul wrote, he wishes people shouldn't get married. Because anyway, Paul does a lot of things that he says that Jesus is not really, Jesus may not agree with everything that Paul says specifically about women. A friend of mine, Reverend Terrence Thomas from Bethel AME in Chicago, says that Paul ain't really know Jesus like that, which is true. Paul does not know Jesus. He didn't meet Jesus like that. So when we talk about a hermeneutic of suspicion, I have to be suspicious of anyone who was against the movement, then for the movement, then led the movement. But Paul was never in the movement. Paul was never a disciple. And so when I look at the things that Jesus said, then I'm like, wait, some of this stuff is a lot different. Now, who is more likely to preach about forgiveness than the person who's persecuting Christians and doing all of this? Like, you hear a lot of stuff from Paul, who I'm willing to bet was a little insecure about his role in this. Like, he probably felt bad that I did all of this stuff. And so we really should forgive people. We really should overlook their past. We really, that's Paul. That's So what did Jesus say? Jesus said, yeah, we hear a lot about you should forgive your brother 70 times 7 and all that stuff. But that's not all Jesus said about forgiveness. Jesus said to that tree that didn't produce fruit, he cursed the tree and the tree died. There was no opportunity for forgiveness for that tree.
Right.
When Jesus said, if anyone causes any of these little ones to sin, it's better for a millstone to be tied around their neck and for him to be thrown into the sea. That person is not forgiven. Everyone is not forgiven. There are some things that you can do that do not deserve the forgiveness. And absolutely, I'm talking from Jesus's perspective. Yes, absolutely, you forgive your brother all those times. And absolutely, also, when you commit grievous sins like this, your time is up. Mm-hmm. Now, that's him making that call. So if we're going to listen to Jesus, we got to listen to all of what Jesus is saying. We can't pick and choose the stuff that makes us feel better and makes us not look at our past and try to sweep it under the rug. That's a Paul Christian. So what type of Christian are you? Like, who are you following? Are you following Paul, who ain't really know Jesus like that? Or are you following Jesus?
As Richard Spencer said, he was culturally Christian, that he was not spiritually Christian. He was culturally Christian. And I said, well, that's a problem, because what is that? And really what he was talking about was that civil religion that has juxtaposed nationalism and patriotism with religious fervor. And the question you ask is timely and it's important. You know, people have to not be afraid to deconstruct some of this stuff, because you say, how do we get there and what do we do? But the truth of the matter is, we're going to have some people who are willing to confront the supremacist energy, the supremacist infusion in their Christian character and in their Christian behaviors. So, you know, their interactions.
Yeah.
And really root that out. So, and that's hard. And this is what I'm talking about. Certain things might happen instantly, where a person like touching a hot stove says, I'll never vote for a Trump Republican again, versus the things that have to happen long term, which is like holding states like Texas to a higher standard with their textbooks, or you know, the certain states. I call out Texas because it's well known, but there are other states who have issues with textbooks because they're not even comfortable mm-hmm. with presenting historical facts in ways that don't hurt imaginary feeling, you know, and the social scientist in me will always be disappointed in that, because again, we see that that has very real consequences in the real world when you mislearn your history.
Yeah.
And it's not, I don't want it to be overwhelming, but like, that's a lot. That's a lot. Like, we could start this work right now and not see the results of it for 20 years until we start to see people actually understanding civics again. Understanding how local, state, and national government work, understanding what congressional representation is supposed to do and not do. And when you talk about, you know, the federal judiciary, it's enough work for everybody. You know, will we ever do anything about this huge infusion of cash into our politics, our political system that bends and stretches and sometimes totally obliterates the truth?
Yeah.
You know, we have some real character-based issues to confront about America going forward. And, you know, in a bid to Afrofuturism, there's no time like the present for the Black church to decide how far into the leadership and how far into the wise sage class of what we got going on over here in Christendom do we want to be? Because we need to design a way forward. You know, I'm trying to think actively about not so much what it's been, but what it's going to be. It keeps coming up. And I think that's the question here. You know, what is the Black church going to do going forward to make sure that we don't allow these things to passively enter into our houses of worship or our styles of worship or our own Christian culture? We should not be doing the master's bidding on any of this.
Yeah, I agree. And that's who we're speaking to. I mean, we don't have any influence in white churches, but where we live, we got some stuff. And just to clarify for my Bible scholars, yeah, you can listen to Paul for some things. Paul did have some bars when he was talking about for an Adam all die, so in Christ all we made alive. That was cool. For God has bound everyone over to disobedience so that he may have mercy on them all. Bars. Yeah, Paul got some stuff. But you got to know that if we're talking about forgiveness, we can't do it as a blanket application for all things, because that's not what Jesus advocated. And with regard to the church in America, it must do the hard work of staring itself in the mirror to see what it's been, to see what it still is, and decide to earn the forgiveness that it desires. And until that happens, there's no need to worry about what your witness is, how your witness was damaged and all that stuff. It's irrelevant, because you've gone down a path that you must turn away from immediately.
Yeah.
Or you risk the fate of that fig tree.
That's just where we are.
So for Faith Uncut, I am your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
For more on Faith Uncut, check us out at faithuncut.com.